close your eyes for a second. Picture that that iconic Spirit of Ecstasy hood ornament just gliding along. Or maybe you hear that incredible quietness of the engine.
Almost silent.
Exactly. That feeling of, you know, ultimate luxury, top-tier engineering. It really makes you wonder, doesn't it, what actually goes into creating something that revered?
And how do you keep that best car in the world title, that mystique, going for well over 100 years now?
Well, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are getting right into the amazing history of Rolls-Royce motor cars.
Yeah, peeling back the layers.
Our mission, to go beyond just the shiny metal and fancy leather. We want to uncover the visionaries, the maybe unexpected twists, and that constant, relentless drive for perfection that defines the brand.
We've dug into the sources, the history.
And we're aiming to give you that shortcut, you know? Wow. The key insights, the surprising facts, so you're really clued in on this automotive legend.
And it is a legend. Securing that reputation is one thing, but holding on to it through everything, wars, recessions, different owners, and it's something else entirely.
It really is. It's not just about building a great car, though obviously that's crucial.
No, it's about a philosophy, a vision that lasts.
Okay, so let's rewind. Right back to the start. 1904, Charles Stuart Rolls.
Right. Born in Mayfair, London, Eton, Cambridge.
Yeah.
Engineering degree. Definitely came from privilege.
And he jumps straight into the car world, sets himself up as a dealer, C.S. Rolls & Co., gets a pretty hefty loan from his dad, too, £6,600.
Which was a lot of money back then. He started off importing French Peugeots, Belgian Minervas.
But he quickly spots a gap, right? His wealthy customers, they wanted something more.
Exactly. They weren't just after transport. They wanted real luxury, refinement, reliability, stuff that just wasn't quite there in the imports he was selling.
This sort of desire for something better, it led him to a really crucial meeting.
The pivotal one, yeah. You wouldn't think a little two-cylinder car would be the catalyst.
So 1904, Royal Automobile Club in London, he meets Henry Edmonds, who's a director at Royce LTD.
And Edmonds shows Rolls their new car, the Royce 10.
What was it about that car, a two-cylinder? What grabbed Rolls?
That's the fascinating bit. It wasn't the specs on paper. Rolls saw past the engine size. He saw the quality, yeah, the potential.
Ah, okay.
Even though it was small, the Royce 10 was incredibly well-made.
Yeah.
Smooth, reliable. Which was revolutionary when most cars were, frankly, pretty rough and ready.
Okay, so it was the craftsmanship.
Absolutely. He knew this was the kind of engineering his clients were looking for, the foundation for a proper luxury brand.
So he sees the spark, and this leads to that legendary meeting, the big one, with the man himself, Henry Royce, Midland Hotel, Manchester, May 4th, 1904.
That was it. The moment it all came together. Rolls was so impressed, so confident in Royce's engineering, he basically agreed on the spot to buy every single car Royce could build.
Wow, just like that.
Just like that. On the condition they'd be badged Rolls-Royce and sold only through his dealership, C.S. Rolls & Co.
A pretty bold move.
Hugely ambitious.
Yeah.
And it happened fast. The first official Rolls-Royce, the 10HP, debuted just months later at the Paris Salon, December 1904.
Incredible. From spotting potential in a small car to launching a legendary brand in, what, less than a year?
It really was a whirlwind start.
So the partnerships formed. The next few years, say 1906 to 1910, Rolls-Royce just takes off, doesn't it? Building this amazing reputation.
They really did. In a time when cars were often unreliable, clunky things,
yeah,
Rolls-Royces stood out. Smoothness, reliability. Those were the key differentiators.
And this success even took Rolls over to the U.S. in 1906, setting up shop in New York.
Establishing a distributorship, yeah. Building the brand internationally early on.
But here's where the story takes a bit of a turn, something I find really interesting. Despite the car company booming,
Charles Rolls himself starts looking elsewhere.
His attention shifts dramatically to aviation. Brand new technology back then.
It really speaks volumes about him, doesn't it? He wasn't just a businessman. He was a pioneer. Always looking for the next frontier.
Restless spirit.
Totally. Aviation was this whole new world of engineering challenge and, well, pure adventure. Yeah. He bought one of the first Wright Flyers in 1909, started setting records.
Including the first nonstop double crossing of the English Channel. You can see how that would pull you away from, you know, the dealership floor.
Absolutely. The thrill of flight versus the car business.
But while Rolls is up there, literally breaking records, the company back on the ground is developing something huge.
The car that would really define them for years. The Rolls-Royce 4050 horsepower.
With that much smoother six-cylinder engine. Launched at Olympia in 1907.
And by 1908, when it was properly tested, Auto Car Magazine just comes out and declares it the best car in the world.
That's the quote.
That's the one. And it wasn't just hype. That engine, the refinement, the build quality, it set a completely new standard. It was extraordinary for its day.
And the show car, AX201, had that beautiful silver paintwork.
Which led to the nickname Silver Ghost.
Which, again, wasn't official right away.
No, that took until 1921 for the factory to formally adopt it. Started as a nickname, just stuck.
Funny how that happens. But this period, this high point of innovation for the company and personal achievement for Rolls, it ends very suddenly and tragically.
Terribly sad. July 1910, Charles Rolls was flying his Wright Flyer at an event in Bournemouth, Haingisbury Airfield.
And it crashed.
Yeah, he was killed instantly. Became the first person in Britain to die in a powered aircraft accident.
Awful. It really makes you wonder, how does a company founded on this kind of pioneering drive cope with losing one of its figureheads so early on?
It's a huge question. I think it shows the strength of the foundation Henry Royce and the team had already built. That commitment to excellence was already embedded deeper than just one person, even a founder.
And maybe nothing embodies that enduring spirit better than the hood ornament itself, the spirit of ecstasy.
Ah, yes. The Flying Lady, introduced in 1911.
Designed by Charles Sykes. But the story behind who it's modeled on is fascinating.
It really is. Not just some generic figure. It's based on a real person. Eleanor Velasco Thornton.
Who was she?
She was the private secretary to Lord Montague, who was a big Rolls-Royce customer back then.
And the original version tells a bit of a secret story.
Exactly. The very first one, commissioned just for Lord Montague's car, is called the Whisper. It's incredibly rare.
Okay.
And it shows Eleanor with her finger pressed to her lips. The rumor, the whisper, was that it signified a secret love affair between her and Lord Montague.
Wow. So this incredibly famous symbol of luxury started as a secret signal.
Pretty much. A very personal, almost scandalous little sculpture that ironically became this global symbol of discretion and exclusivity. It shows how personal stories get woven into a brand's identity.
And apparently only the Montague family can still order the Whisper today.
That's the understanding, yes. Amazing detail.
So building on the Silver Ghost's success, 1925 brings another icon, the Phantom.
The direct replacement for the 4050 Silver Ghost. And it came with some serious engineering upgrades.
Like what?
Well, the big one was the engine. A revolutionary pushrod OHV six-cylinder. That overhead valve design was a big step up in power and efficiency for the time.
Did it keep the same chassis?
It carried over the 4050 chassis, yes. But the suspension got a major overhaul. Semi-elliptical springs at the front, cantilever springs at the rear.
And that created the famous
magic carpet ride. That's what people called it. It just cemented that reputation. Best cars in the world. A huge leap in comfort.
Then 1931, the family gets bigger. Bentley joins the fold.
Yes, Rolls-Royce bought Bentley Motors. Bentley was struggling financially during the Great Depression.
So do they keep them as totally separate brands?
Not exactly. Rolls-Royce made a strategic choice. They decided to use the Bentley badge for the sportier models in their combined range.
Ah, clever. So Rolls-Royce for ultimate luxury, Bentley for luxury with a sportier edge.
Precisely. A pragmatic way to appeal to a slightly different buyer while leveraging both prestigious names during tough economic times.
Makes sense. And then just a couple of years later, 1933, a small change, but one people often get wrong. The badge color. Red to black.
Yes. The common myth is it was done out of respect for Henry Royce, who died in March 1933.
But that's not it.
No, the real reason was much more aesthetic, really.
Yeah.
The red background sometimes clashed awkwardly with certain paint colors customers chose for their cars.
Ah. So it's about color coordination.
Essentially, yes. Shows that incredible attention to detail, even in the smallest things. Everything had to be perfect.
Okay, let's jump forward. Post-war era, 1946. Big changes afoot. Production moves.
Right. After World War II, Rolls-Royce Motor Cars moves production to a factory in Crewe.
Which had a history itself, didn't it?
It did. It had been used during the war to build Rolls-Royce Merlin and Griffin Aero engines. Famous engines.
So plenty of space, skilled workers.
Exactly. And that space was needed because Rolls-Royce started doing something new, building their own coachwork in-house.
How did that come about?
They'd acquired the rest of Park Ward Limited, the famous coach builders they'd partly owned since the 30s. Bringing it all under one roof gave them more control.
And this led to a really significant model in 1955, the Silver Cloud.
The Silver Cloud.
Yeah.
A real departure. For the first time, Rolls-Royce designed and built its own standard body using pressed steel.
Making it lighter, cheaper.
Both. Lighter, yes, and much cheaper to produce than the traditional custom coach-built bodies. It retailed for just over £5,000, including taxes.
Which was still a lot, but more accessible.
Definitely more accessible. Though, interestingly, the traditional buyers weren't all convinced at first.
Oh, really? Why not?
Some found the design a bit bulbous, mm-hmm. apparently, and they didn't like having fewer bespoke options.
But this move, it seems counterintuitive, maybe diluting the brand, but it worked.
It worked spectacularly well, actually. By making a Rolls-Royce slightly more attainable, they opened the doors to a whole new generation. Younger buyers, trendsetters.
People like Elvis Presley, John Lennon, Sinatra.
Exactly. Cultural icons. It broadened the brand's appeal massively. Shows that even ultra-luxury brands need to adapt sometimes.
A fascinating strategy. Then, 1965, another big step. The Silver Shadow.
Right. Car design was moving towards Monaco construction, integrating the body and chassis into one unit.
Stronger, more modern.
Yes. The Silver Shadow brought Rolls-Royce into that era. Unitary body and chassis.
And it had that famous suspension.
The hydropneumatic system. Using fluid and gas for this incredibly smooth, self-leveling ride. It was revolutionary for the time.
And the Shadow was a massive hit, wasn't it?
Huge. Still the best-selling Rolls-Royce model ever. Over 30,000 sold across its long life.
Spawned other models too, like the Corniche.
The Corniche convertible and coupe, yeah, and the quite distinctive Pininfarina design Camargue. Its success really paved the way for the next generation.
Which was the Silver Spirit arriving in 1981.
The Spirit was definitely a response to growing competition, particularly from the Germans, Mercedes-Benz especially. The Shadow was getting a bit dated by then.
So evolution rather than revolution.
Kind of, based on the Shadow's floor pan, but with updated self-leveling suspension, better ride, improved three-speed automatic gearbox. It kept them competitive.
And had its own variations, like the Silver Spur.
Exactly. The long wheelbase spur and the very plush Park Ward limousine version kept the lineage going.
Okay, so despite all this history, this incredible run, by the early 2000s, things weren't looking quite so rosy for Rolls-Royce.
No, the brand was definitely struggling a bit. Bentley sales had actually overtaken them, which was a big shock. And the Silver Seraph launched in 98. It just wasn't clicking with buyers.
And something needed to change, a big change.
And it arrived in 2003 in the shape of BMW.
Right. BMW bought the rights to the Rolls-Royce name after VW had acquired Bentley.
Which meant BMW had a huge task. They couldn't just tweak the existing cars. They had to develop a completely new model, even build a whole new factory. It was a total reset.
A ground-up rebirth.
Yeah.
And the factory they built, quite something.
At Goodwood, yeah. On Lord March's estate in West Sussex. State-of-the-art, designed to be environmentally sensitive. Very impressive.
And out of this came the Phantom 7.
The first BMW-era Rolls, built on a lightweight aluminum space frame chassis, powered by a big BMW 6.75-liter V12.
And it was a hit. Why did it connect so well?
I think a huge part of it was the sheer level of customization they offered. It blew people away.
Like what specifically?
Get this. 44,000 standard paint colors to choose from. Or they'd match any color you brought them. Any leather color for the interior. You could have your initials inlaid in the dashboard wood.
Wow. True bespoke luxury.
Exactly. And they brought back the rear-hinged coach doors, the so-called suicide doors, which just add this incredible sense of arrival, letting passengers step out gracefully.
It really felt like they understood modern luxury personalization, effortless style.
And the engineering to back it up. It absolutely reestablished them as making the best car in the world.
And they didn't just stick to the ultra high-end. 2009 saw the Ghost.
The Ghost. Aimed at a slightly younger buyer, maybe someone who'd drive themselves more often. A nod to the original Silver Ghost name.
But it shared parts with the BMW to keep costs down.
Yeah, up to 20% of its platform and components were shared with the BMW 7 Series. A pragmatic decision.
But did it feel like a proper Rolls-Royce? That was the risk, wasn't it?
That was the genius of it. Despite the shared underpinnings, it absolutely delivered the Rolls-Royce experience. The imposing presence, the quiet ride, the incredible interior luxury.
Yeah.
It was all there.
BMW nailed that balance.
They really did. And the Ghost was hugely successful, spawning the Wraith Coupe and the Dawn Convertible, became a cornerstone of their lineup.
The innovation kept rolling. 2017, a new Phantom, the Phantom 8.
Even more advanced. Enhanced self-leveling air suspension, electronically controlled dampers, active anti-roll bars for stability, even special Continental tires designed with foam inside to cut road noise even further.
Just relentless refinement.
Always pushing the boundaries of comfort and silence, plus, of course, even more personalization options.
And then 2018. A real curveball, something completely new for Rolls-Royce.
The Cullinan, their first ever SUV.
A Rolls-Royce SUV, who is that aimed at?
Primarily buyers in emerging luxury markets, places where road conditions might be more varied, and where SUVs are hugely popular status symbols.
Built on the same platform as the Phantom?
Yes, the same architecture of luxury aluminum space frame shared the V12 engine too, but with its own unique all-wheel drive system.
Did it work? An SUV Rolls-Royce.
It's been incredibly successful. It really marked the completion of their turnaround under BMW, made them highly profitable, and proved they could translate that Rolls-Royce magic into a totally different type of vehicle. A bold move that absolutely paid off.
This enduring appeal, this value, it's not just about the driving experience or collecting them, is it? It translates into actual financial worth.
Tangible asset value, yeah.
Which brings us to a really unexpected connection. We're going to link these incredible luxury cars to the world of high-end pawnbroking.
It sounds strange at first, but it makes perfect sense when you think about it.
How so? How do Rolls-Royces fit into that world?
Well, places like New Bond Street Pawnbrokers in London, they specialize in high-value assets. And classic and modern Rolls-Royces are definitely that.
So people use their Rolls-Royce as collateral for a loan.
Exactly. These places offer discreet professional services. They have decades of experience. New Bond Street says over 60 years valuing luxury goods, including cars like Rolls-Royce.
Why are Rolls-Royces particularly good for this?
Because their value tends to be very stable, sometimes even appreciating. The brand recognition, the quality, the heritage, it means they hold their value exceptionally well. They're a solid, recognized asset globally.
Makes sense. And the founder of New Bond Street Pawnbrokers, David Sonnenthal, he's quite the backstory himself.
Oh, absolutely fascinating character. Not your typical pawnbroker background at all.
He was an actor, a successful one.
Very successful. He actually won the Perry Award, that's a huge comedy award, at the Edinburgh Fringe back in 1996.
Wow. So how do you go from award-winning performer to luxury pawnbroker?
Apparently, it was almost by accident. He was at an acting audition in London in 1999, saw the shop premises, and just had this vision for its potential.
Seize the opportunity.
Totally. And he's become incredibly respected in the pawnbroking industry since. Won their National Pawnbroker Association Award loads of times, 2023, 2022, 2021, 2019, back in 2008, too.
It's a great story. Connects that timeless Rolls-Royce allure, its solid value with modern finance, and this unique personality who bridges entertainment and business.
And he still keeps a foot in the entertainment world. He's the resident dealer on that Channel 4 show, Four Rooms.
Right. I've seen that. It's an amazing journey, isn't it? From those early workshops in Manchester to global showrooms, the skies over the channel, and even the discreet offices of Mayfair Pawnbrokers.
Quite the trajectory.
So let's wrap this up. We've journeyed through the incredible story of Rolls-Royce, from Rolls' vision and Royce's genius.
Through the elegance of the Spirit of Ecstasy, the game-changing Phantom, the accessibility of the Silver Cloud, the success of the Silver Shadow.
Right up to the BMW era, the rebirth with Phantom the Seventh, the smart strategy of the Ghost, the bold move with the Cullinan SUV.
And even touching on how their enduring value makes them significant assets in the world of high-end finance.
The constant theme, the thread running through it all, seems to be that relentless pursuit of being the best.
Absolutely. That's how they've kept this unparalleled reputation alive for over a century. Adapting, innovating, but never losing sight of that core identity, ultimate luxury, peerless engineering, meticulous craftsmanship.
It really is a masterclass in brand building and endurance.
A testament to vision and sticking to your principles, decade after decade.
So, thinking about this whole legacy, the innovation, the luxury, the personal stories like Eleanor Thornton or David Sonnenthal, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? What really is the essence of Rolls-Royce's appeal today in the 21st century?
And where does an icon like this go next? Electrification. Even more extreme customization. Autonomous luxury.
Exactly. Where does Rolls-Royce drive from here? Something for you to think about. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.